Coming up on Broadway Videos this week on Broadway, we talk about the Thespian Festival in Lincoln, Nebraska. Little Shop of Horrors at Encores Off-Center, It Should Have Been You on Broadway, and MTC's Of Good Stock. That plus some news. Please stay tuned.
I'm tired of being your bitch. Are you drunk? I'm gonna get me a little something-something and a little something else on the side. What are you talking about? Everybody else is celebrating. I wanna hop on that ride. Fix me a drink, don't you dare. Then double it up. And when my glass is empty, refill my cup. 'Cause I'm gonna get me a little something.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway for Sunday, July 5th, 2015. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast this morning, we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Kritzerland, Masterworks Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talk and Broadway, The Sondheim Review, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You can see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
So Peter was away last week because he was at the Thespian Festival, and we're all really interested to hear about this. So Peter wanted to tell us.
You bet. In Lincoln, Nebraska, thousands, literally thousands of kids converge to either put on their shows that they've done at their own high schools, or they come to watch other people's productions. There are not one, not two, but three theaters. One is called the Carson Theater because it's named for Johnny Carson, that old Tonight Show host who gave $5.3 million to make a little theater of about 250 seats. This is not to be confused with the Howell Theater, which has 318 seats, which is not to be confused with the Lead Center, which has 2,200 seats. Now, you'd say, oh, 2,200 seats, gee, I hope they get filled, you know, I mean, with kids, no problem. There are so many kids, what they have to do, you have a badge that's either yellow or it's blue, and you are assigned certain times to see certain shows. Every main stage show is done twice, and you can go I forgot there's a Kimball Theater too, because there are shows down there as well. It's a recital hall, but they use it as a theater for shows that don't need fly space or any ornate scenery. So you have to go at certain times. That's all there is to it, because there are so many people there. And what's really so wonderful about it is not just that the productions are extraordinary. Yes, they are, and I'll talk about a few of them. But boy, you know, you're really reminded of how nice kids are in theater. They are, when people walk in front of me, when kids walk in front of me, this happened like 50 times, you know, everybody's rushing around. If somebody walks in front of you, the kid always turned around, always, and said, excuse me, I'm sorry. You know, they're so polite. I mean, really, there's something about our theater kids that are just a cut above, no question above that. What I found very interesting was the fact that I was there the week that the Supreme Court made its wonderful decision, and nobody mentioned that. And I suspect the reason was they didn't want to make a big deal of it, you know, because these are kids and they don't want anybody accusing anybody, leading anybody into a certain direction. What I found really, really interesting was that some shows had a gay reference or two, and the kids cheered like crazy whenever that happened. But then there was a production of Smokey Joe's Cafe in which a young boy was singing to a young girl, and a young man came up behind him and put his hands on his hips, and the boy got the impression that it was a girl, and when he turned around, he was thoroughly repulsed that it was a boy, and that crowd did not laugh at all, and I found that very, very interesting. What I also liked very much, again, in Smokey Joe's Cafe, the director decided what would be funny is if during the song Dance With Me, and by the way, this might have been done on Broadway. I shouldn't really necessarily hold the director responsible, but anyway, during Dance With Me, a geeky girl came on with glasses that were broken in the middle with the standard white tape keeping them together. And she's running around, you know, dance with me, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And the kids were not laughing. And because I think that they've been in this position, that they've learned not to make fun of the geeky person because they have felt geeky themselves. You know, it's one of the things I loved about the original sideshow. When they looked out at us and said, come look at the freaks, we all felt like freaks at one point in our lives, you know, and we were relating to them very, very much. So I love the fact that the audiences have been tremendously educated, that the kids are the nicest kids in town. No reflection on Connie Collins and his kids, but these are the nicest kids, and to see them so intent on seeing what everybody brought to this festival. For example, okay, there were musicals as recent as Big Fish. There were musicals as old as White Christmas. Now, you might say White Christmas is only a few years old, but you know the fact that it's a 50s show, I mean, in essence, you know, and some of the songs are even earlier than the 50s that were interpolated into it. And then there was a new show called Hello, My Baby by Sherry Steinkellner, who was one of the book writers on Sister Act. She decided to put together a show dealing with songs from way back when. Many of these songs were 100 years old, and I feared a bit that the kids wouldn't take to them. Oh, but they did. It was really something at the end of the show to hear 2,200 kids singing Hello, My Baby, when the, like a Pippin type of piece of sheet music came down and gave you the lyrics. It was just
That's the song from that famous Bugs Bunny cartoon with the well, it's actually not Bugs Bunny, but the one with the frog.
I don't know this cartoon.
Oh, do you not know this? Oh,
no,
my God.
The lyrics are Hello, My Baby. Hello, My Honey. Hello,
I mean, just quickly, it's like set in the Depression, and some bum finds this frog singing in a construction site, and he grabs it and he takes it and he's going to put it on display. But whenever anyone else is around, it just sits there like a frog. so it's only when he's alone with it that it puts on a top hat and it tells like, "Hello, my baby. Hello, my."
And then I wonder if the kids know this.
It's famous. You must look it up.
You are. You know, maybe that's the reason the kids knew the song. But but even songs like If You Were the Only Girl in the World, you know, which is not a hot song, my point is they come with open minds. They come to enjoy. They come to cheer. They come to cheer each other on. When they're tremendously impressed by dance numbers. And all of this comes down to the fact that they're all looking at these shows and know how hard it is to do them. And as a result, they are appreciating the work that goes into everybody else's show. So the main stage musicals were indeed Hello, My Baby, Big Fish, White Christmas, Xanadu, and The Little Mermaid. There were also smaller productions of The Addams Family, which I did not see because they were running at the same time when I had to be at the other shows, and tiny cuts from Smokey Joe's Cafe and Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. But millions of plays, too, I'm telling you. A big cutting from Art done by three women. God of Carnage had a representation, too. A lot of new plays, a lot of student plays, a ton of workshops, which, in fact, last year I made a big deal of the fact that there was a kid who knocked everybody out at a Shaman and Whitman workshop, a kid named Alex Stone, and he was the lead in Big Fish. And I'm telling you, what a performance. It was just amazing beyond belief, because I didn't even realize how tremendous a role this was when I saw it on Broadway. I only saw it on Broadway once, and I thought Norbert Leo Butz was fine. Sure, good, very good. But I didn't realize what a workload this show has, but this Alex Stone made me see that. And, you know, it was one of these things, like, after he's done everything but sell tickets, suddenly he's in a dance number two and he's tapping away. He can tap too, and what's more, baby, he can tap. I mean, it's just amazing to me what this kid can do, and I'm very happy to say that he's been accepted into the Cincinnati Conservatory of Music, where I go twice a year to see their main stage shows. So I'm certainly looking forward to seeing him in the future, because I think he really has stardom written all over him. But other kids were really marvelous too. It's amazing what these kids can achieve, and I'm just so glad to be able to get out there and spend a week where I saw 20 shows, and I wouldn't have it any other way.
That's so exciting. And Peter, I when we were kind of chatting about it last week while you were not here, maybe your ears were burning, but so this Thespian Festival is not related to the Jimmys, is it?
No. No, they're separate things entirely.
Isn't that great? There's two organizations so much, that are doing
Yeah, I mean, really. This used to be done, I'm told, long before I started going, in Muncie, Indiana, but it outgrew that place. It had to go to someplace bigger. The place where they're playing is literally where Les Mis goes when it comes to Lincoln, Nebraska. I mean, it's a professional theater. You know, so it's really marvelous to see it packed with so many people who just can't wait to get in and see what the next school has to offer. So, and they come from everywhere. In fact, they came from two of them were from foreign countries. I think one was Dubai and the other one was Saipan. But they, yeah, that sounds right. 43 states, I think. Ironically enough, none from New York. Not from New York. I mean, millions from Texas and Colorado, but none from New York. And I wonder why that is. But anyway, don't you want to be a part of it, New York? You know, I think you should. So anyway, get in the ball, New York, because this is really something your kids should be experiencing.
You know, especially with, you know, Stage Door Manor and Uzdan and things like that. Here. I'm surprised not from New York, but it's funny. When I grew up on Long Island and I had to go to Jersey to do good community theater because there was no really good.
It's amazing to me there isn't more theater on Long Island. I mean, after all, Long Island is about as far away as New Jersey is.
Yeah.
Why are there so many professional theaters in New Jersey and so few on Long Island? It's never made sense to me.
I would just only assume back in the day due to accessibility to the city. I'm just guessing.
I know, but was it really that much different? I mean,
yeah, not really.
Jersey?
Not really.
I mean, yeah. I know the bus system has gotten better in New Jersey, and New Jersey Transit, I guess, has improved too. But I would still think, you know, in terms of as the crow flies, it's pretty much the same. You know,
yeah, no, I agree with you, Peter. I've never had an answer for you other than... in every town, dance is a really big thing, but
not right?
really theater. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. In every single town on Long Island that I know about, every little village has got two or three little dance studios where lots of people are doing, and they do sort of musical theater nights and things like that, but not really theater per se. And I've never seen a high school on Long Island that's got a great theater program, but, who knows?
That's interesting.
Yeah, but I used to drive, you know, from Long Island to New Jersey to do community theater because it was not great community theater on Long Island.
Hmm.
Mm. So let's move forward. Michael got a chance to see Little Shop. So Michael, tell us about the Encores production of it.
Well, it was quite a night, or I should say, I guess, two nights and one matinee. This was originally scheduled to be a one-night-only concert as part of the Encore's off-center season, and it sold so well that they added two more performances. And it was quite extraordinary, with Ellen Green recreating her original role of Audrey, looking fantastic and sounding pretty much the same to me. I mean, really, if I didn't know, I would not never have guessed how much time had passed. And she deserved every accolade she got. She is someone who has been rarely seen since for various reasons. So all the more reason why this whole thing had such an event vibe about it. And sometimes those things pan out and sometimes they don't, but this time it definitely did. If her presence wasn't enough, Jake Gyllenhaal was superb as Seymour. It wasn't a surprise to me that he sings so well, because I certainly remember when he did that little bit on Saturday Night Live some years ago where he sang "And I Am Telling You I'm Not Going." And even though that was a spoof, it was still obvious that he had a really good voice, because it was very, very high. And I remember thinking, gosh, he can really sing. So I'm so glad he decided to do this. I think I've heard that he actually initiated him getting the role, that he had his people contact them when he heard they were doing it. And it might not have seemed initially like such a great idea because for several reasons, he's known to be such a good looking young guy, whereas Seymour is supposed to be very much a nerd. That's part of the plot, and it's mentioned. And then there is quite an age difference between him and Ellen Green, but it just didn't matter. He had quite a thick beard and glasses, and he very shapeless clothing, and it absolutely worked as far as him being not especially attractive. So that was, I mean, and you know, he is quite a bona fide movie star. So there you had this really treasured performer, Ellen Green, from theater, who's not seen often in her signature role, and this, you know, still viable movie star making his, for all intents and purposes, his musical theater debut. And acting wise, he was also fantastic. He did the dialect perfectly. So they were amazing together. And on top of that, you had Joe Grafassi as Mushnick, whom I love. And the three, the three urchins were Tracy Nicole Chapman, Marva Hicks, and Ramona Keller. Talk about luxury casting. And then you had, well, this person was a surprise to me because I'm not that familiar with him, but Taron Killam as the dentist and several other roles. And he not only was his comedy perfection, but his singing was also excellent. And just to round out the rest of it, you had Eddie Cooper, Chuck Cooper's son, as Audrey II, the plant. Chuck was supposed to do it himself, but he was unable to, I think because of Amazing Grace. He's in that, isn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So Eddie Cooper's son, whom I had not previously known or heard of, did it, and he had an amazing voice. He did it except for the first scene or two where the plant is very small and in which it was played by Anwar Karim, little boy of about, I guess, maybe like 8 years old. And it was so sweet because he came out with this tiny little version of the plant. And then when Eddie Cooper came out the first time, he had a much larger version of it, just carrying it. And that was the way it was done. This was not done full out in a full staging with the animatronic plant. But, you know, here's a perfect example of how sometimes you lose something and you gain something in the process. It would have been nice to have the animatronic plant, but because we didn't, and because it was just the actor there, Eddie Cooper, he could do all of these facial expressions and acting that you just, you know, you can't quite get in one of those mechanical things. So it brought a whole new feeling to those songs that the plant sings. And it was fantastic. The band was amazing. Alan Menken was there that night. I'm so glad he got to see it. He may have been there all three nights for all I know. Chris Fenwick was the music director. The staging by Dick Scanlon, who, as far as I know, is not known as a director, but it was just perfect, just enough. There were lots of places where people held their scripts and referred to them in a few sections, mostly I would say mostly non-musical sections, but it was sort of throughout, except for Ellen Green, who didn't have a script for a moment, which is not terribly surprising. It really was just one of those extraordinary, I would say once in a lifetime, but in this case, I guess three times in a lifetime events. And I'm so glad that Janine Tesori picked this show to be part of the series. You know, you can't know for sure when lightning is going to strike, and it's so hard to predict. And when it does, it really is great and so wonderful to give a treasured veteran performer like that, who's really not seen that often anymore, this amazing little rebirth with the audience going nuts and stellar reviews. It was quite something.
A couple of observations here. My buddy Josh Ellis wrote and said, gee, you know, it was so funny back in 1966 when Ethel Merman was doing Annie Get Your Gun. It was called Granny Get Your Gun because she was 58 and Bruce Yarnell playing Frank Butler was 31. You know, and but there's a bigger age difference here.
Yes.
The difference, though, is this is a spoof to begin with, you know, and so as a result, it really doesn't matter nearly as much in a show like this. But Annie Get Your Gun is more of a realistic musical. And in fact, I may have mentioned this over the years, but in Granny Get Your Gun, it was so interesting that every time they were supposed to kiss, they hugged. That was it. They never kissed. They only hugged a lot. And I was quite aware of that. But anyway, the thing is that it doesn't matter in a show like Little Shop when it's done in this type of situation. Nobody's going to complain, especially when you got the original cast member there. The other thing, last night I was walking home and I ran into Dick Scanlon, who lives in my neighborhood. And of course, I was full of congratulations. And I said, you know, really, let's face it. You really didn't expect it to be this sensational, did you? And he said, no, not this sensational. I mean, it took me by surprise, but I wanted to tell you this. The hardest working man in show business is Jake Gyllenhaal. He comes early. He stays late. He does everything you tell him. He's always there to explore. He's just tremendous, and I just hope he keeps on coming back to doing shows because he really puts his heart and soul and every ounce of his body into it. So that was nice to hear.
That is wonderful to hear, and also that he's obviously he's not into grandstanding. He's not into look at the two plays that he picked.
Yeah,
to appear in before. It's sure. it's not as if they were star vehicles
where, right.
You know, where he's playing this hot young guy. He really seems like the real deal. I'm so glad to hear Dick confirm that. And I hope I think he will make time for theater throughout his career, regardless of how high he soars in the film stardom area.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I have a question about the show. Do you know the show pretty well, Peter, the show version as compared to the film version?
I think so. Tell me what you mean.
Well, it's just there's the one song that the lyrics were rewritten for, and I was wondering why they did it. There's a song in the movie called Some Fun Now. And they sing it in the show but with different lyrics. I guess it's the one called You Never Know.
I don't know any of this.
Okay, yeah. Well, if one of our readers, any of our readers, know, if any of our listeners, you could read us too if you want.
Yes.
If any of our listeners know, I'd really be curious to hear that. I mean, I don't know if they've said why they rewrote it, but it just seemed like the original lyrics were fine, and then was rewritten for this number called "Some Fun Now" in the movie.
All right. So if you do know that information, you know, drop Michael an email. All contact information is at BroadwayRadio.com.
I think that should count as our trivia question this week.
Oh. Do you want to formalize it, Michael? Ask the question.
Why did they rewrite the lyrics for the song, which I guess is called You Never Know, as Some Fun Now for the film version of Little Shop of Horrors?
Have you seen the original ending of the movie with the Statue of Liberty? Do you know?
Well, yes, it's out now. And
no, I'm just wondering if you've seen it. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. And you know, I have to say, and actually, maybe this is heresy. I like the ending that the release version of the film. I think, you know, people like the restored ending where the plant goes crazy and eats the world and Audrey dies. The plant kills Audrey.
Sure.
To me, I don't, maybe it's just me. It's a little too bleak, even for this kind of a musical. I don't think we want to see Audrey die no matter what, even though it's a cartoon and blah, blah, blah. And even though that's how it is in the Roger Corman film. So I like the version of the release version of the film where it looks like a happy ending, but then it says the end and then it says question mark because we see a little, like I think a little pod of the plant growing on the, you know, next to their white picket fence or something like that.
Peter, so speaking of the ending of A Statue of Liberty, it reminds me of Planet of the Apes and how popular Planet of the Apes was in the 70s. Was there ever a thought of putting it on stage?
Never heard of a musical version.
Planet of the Apes, the musical. Exclamation point.
If we live long enough, I wouldn't be a bit surprised if it happens.
Not even in a fringe.
Yeah, right. That's what's really surprising. I mean, with all the junky musicals we get in the fringe, you would think that one of them would be Planet of the Apes. But don't give anybody any ideas, James.
All right, I'm sure it's just between us.
Sure, there's one overriding reason for why we have not seen that.
Sure. Because cost. Of the masks. Oh, cost.
Cost.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I suppose.
The rights.
There's that Statue of Liberty from Rags of almost 30 years ago. Maybe they put that into play. So I'm not giving him any ideas. No.
No.
All right.
No. Don't they still have the Statue of Liberty at the paper mill warehouse?
I don't know. Do they?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
So Peter got a chance to go back to see It Should Have Been You at the Brooks Atkinson, which has announced a closing date of August 9th, 2015. So Peter, tell us about It Should Have Been You.
Well, the reason I went is because Music Theater International, for whom I do a column each Friday, bought the rights. So I thought, okay, let me start writing about this, for the stock and amateur market. And I liked it when I saw it in George Street. I liked it when I saw it the first time on Broadway. I liked it again. What was so impressive to me was that the audience was crazy for it, just crazy for it. Every joke landed. And what was so nice is the fact that the cast was really, really trying. I've seen so many times when closings are announced that they just phone it in terribly, perfunctorily, and this was not happening remotely. Everybody was just terrific in doing what he or she could to give the audience a fabulous time. I'm convinced the reason the show failed has a lot to do with the fact that that unit set. I hate the set for this show. And I'm going to caution people who are producing musicals not to do a unit set. For example, there's one scene where there are two doors on the set, and you say, okay, that must be a room. No, it turns out to be the ladies' room, and they're supposed to be stalls, but they don't play as stalls. They play as doors, and as a result, you don't look at doors and immediately say, oh, they must be in a ladies' room. It's not until the scene is well into a few lines that it's established it's a ladies' room, but you discombobulate it at that point. I think the show would have been much better off if it had used projections. I don't like projections a lot, but at least it would have been clearer where everybody was, because it really seems like everything's happening in the hotel lobby, and it's just ridiculous. And, I understand it took a long time for this show to get here. I think it was something like 4 years since that George Street production. Okay, I understand that. I understand that money's tight. I understand it's a miracle it got here. But when it really comes down to it, if you're going to have a unit set, in the end, might very well be cost ineffective, because what you are doing is essentially saying, well, if we skimp here, we'll be able to get it on. Yes, but you'll get it on, but you'll probably be unsuccessful because people just won't know exactly where they are. So I think you're better off raising the extra money. I know this is easy for me to say, raising the extra money and getting a real set that would help. I can't say that I have any real suggestions beyond projections. I wish that I could, but I'm not a set designer, to say the least. But this would be a phenomenal challenge for a set designer, because this happens in a million places in this hotel. And the sad thing is to see a show that is so accomplished in so many ways. Yes, a lot of people say, oh, it's just like a Neil Simon play with music. Yeah, but those Neil Simon plays brought a lot of pleasure to a lot of people and still do here and there. And I really think that there's not very much fat on this show, that the jokes are there to be to make their points, and they're quick, they're efficient, and I'm going to say that you have a month left to see It Should Have Been You, and I really think you should give it your consideration and decide to go. Things might have been different too, of course, if the Tony Committee had smiled even a little, and of course it didn't smile at all on this show, and I think that was wrong, especially for Lisa Howard, who, again, everybody just adores and gets the last bow, even though you have two Tony winners up there, Tyne Daly and Harriet Harris, who are terrific as well. So I don't think one joke in that show fell flat the other night. I mean, everyone was greeted with such enthusiasm. And again, maybe the place was papered. I don't think so. I know there are discounts out there. Ironically enough, soon after I left the theater, I went to buy some groceries. There was a flyer there for, I think, $75. Okay, however they get in, whatever they're spending, the fact is they had a hell of a time. And I dare say you will, too. So Unicet be damned, yes, but it should have been you. Really, I think you should have been there by now. And if you haven't, by all means, go.
Peter, was David Burtka still in it when you went? Because I heard that he left. I think it was not intended to be permanent, but now the show is closing. Was he still in it?
No. No, his understudy was in. I didn't realize that. So he may very well not come back?
Well, I'm not sure, because when is the closing date?
August 9th.
Oh, well, I suppose he will. He took something like a 2 or 3 week hiatus. So I guess he'll be back.
He's still on the website. I can't agree with Peter more. I really enjoyed this show. I loved it. I'm so sad it's not finding a market, just as we had talked a few months ago when it first opened, about the similarities to like the First Date, which was on here a year or so ago. I really enjoyed it, and I think it's a wonderful show, and I think it's going to get done a million places after it closes on Broadway.
I hope so.
As I think I said, literally no one I have spoken to didn't like it.
My experience too, Michael. Really, and I'm talking a lot of people go to the theater quite a bit. You know, everybody I know seems to understand the show succeeded in what it wanted to do.
Yes.
You know, it hit the bullseye as much as it wanted to hit the bullseye. So I think that's very impressive.
And I think that James's comparison to First Date is apt in another respect, because I do think that in both cases, the scores, the music and lyrics themselves are – I would say only serviceable. Is that a good word?
Yes. Fair.
Not exceptional, but the job is done. You know.
Yes. A lot of it, because they're comedy songs, and comedy songs lend themselves to patter. Mm.
Sure.
You know, I mean, that's what it really comes down to.
Yes, and in that sense, they were very wise to pick the song that they picked for Lisa Howard to sing on the Tonys.
Yes. And business did go up that next week. I dare say Lisa sold tickets.
Oh, good.
It really jumped tremendously. It hasn't since, I'll grant you. But that week, it really went up substantially, and I dare say that was the reason why.
Well, you know, she is so great. She was so great in Spelling Bee, and then did either of you see her in Silence, the musical?
No.
Yeah.
She was unbelievable. She's really just...
Well, another Cincinnati graduate who I saw play the Olga Bell in Little Me and Fosca in Passion, and she was phenomenal then, so it doesn't surprise me at all.
No, I knew her from then. That's great to watch her since the early days.
And, you know, John Waters says one of the great things about writing Hairspray is that he's written a part for a heavyset kid. You know, there will always be a kid in high school who will now have a role if he's heavy set. Well, the same thing with this part. You know, now there's going to be a part for a girl who's heavy set as well. Yes, of course, Tracy Turnblad fits that bill as well. But you can only do Hairspray once, you know.
Once a year.
You know, every now and then. You know, I mean, you know, what I'm saying is, through a 4-year career of high school, chances are a kid will only do Hairspray once. You know, maybe that'll be junior year. Senior year can be this one or the other way around. Mm. So it's nice that there's another role for a heavyset girl.
Yeah.
And a damn good role, too.
All right, so Peter also got a chance to get over to Manhattan Theater Club to see Of Good Stock, which is playing through July 26th. Peter, tell us about that.
Yeah, this is a play that takes place in a Cape Cod house, summer house, that used to belong to this reasonably famous author, and he left it to one of his daughters, not all three of his daughters. Needless to say, there's going to be a little bit of strife over that, to say the least. Well, this is a play by Melissa Ross, who is certainly one of our upcoming playwrights. And she does the job very well in terms of setting up the fact that the sister who owns the house, who has been sick with breast cancer, I'm sorry to say, is having her other two sisters over and the men in their lives. Well, what's going to happen? I mean, what happens when family gets together? So there's nothing terribly surprising about that, I'll grant you. So while the plot seems a little tired, what's really important is the characterizations and the dialogue. And those are in good shape up until the penultimate scene. But anyway, what we're talking about here is that Jennifer Mudge is marvelous as Jess, the one who has the breast cancer. But I also thought that Heather Lind, who played Celia, who now has a real life change coming up, a tremendous life change coming up that she has made impulsively. And her sisters are appalled at what she's doing with her life and her new boyfriend. So that brings up some interesting complications. But the other sister, too, who is, again, wonderfully played as well. It's a very, very strong cast by Alicia Silverstone, who is getting married. And it's one of those situations. If this sounds a little trite, I understand it. But what is happening is that she's just so overwhelmed, and there's nothing else in her life but the wedding. That's all she talks about. That's all she's planning. It's the invitations go out. The invitations are the type of cards when you open up, music plays, that type of thing. So it's all about that and the men in their lives. One of the men in this play will disappear rather quickly, and that brings up a lot of complications as well. But I talked about the penultimate scene. I'm no stickler for language, but I would say that in the penultimate scene, that famous four-letter word beginning with an F constitutes 20% of the dialogue, maybe 30, maybe 50. I'm telling you, it's just that these women go on a rampage and they start condemning everything that they have seen, done, or experienced in the last 24 hours. So I think this is an easier way of well, not so much an easy way. There's not an easier way of doing it, believe me. That's a very easy way of doing it. Mm. But there's a better way of doing it. And to me, it really soured the play. And I felt bad for the Manhattan Theater Club audience, which didn't want to take this ride with this playwright in this scene. And I was a little surprised even that director Lynn Menno said, well, this will be right for my subscribers, because it certainly wasn't the day I was there. So for those who don't like that type of language, and certainly to the excess that it is used, there's nothing else in the scene but just yelling out, no. This F this and F that. And I mean, that's really the scene. It does redeem itself in the final scene, I'll grant you. But I wonder if we really had to get used to that type of scene where nothing else happens but that, that they get so angry. There is one dramatic thing that happens during that scene that's really, really powerful, I'll grant you. And what's really interesting about it is that it doesn't involve a single word. It's an action that one of the characters takes. And it's really, really fascinating to see. So all things considered, aside from one scene, Of Good Stock is really of good stock. It's very well written with characters that engage you, and if the situation seems a little familiar, at least the people are more interesting than the situation.
So great. That, as I mentioned before, that's playing through July 26th, so you have a few weeks to check it out at Manhattan Theater Club, and we'll have a link to that. They also have a promotional video that I threw into the show notes, so you can take a look at that, although I don't know if it's the F this, F that scene. But
Yeah, I really hate that, too, for the record. I think I've mentioned that in the past. And I saw a play recently that turned out to be pretty good, but the first scene was laden with that word, and it took it a while to recover, in my opinion. It's just so cheap and so easy, and after a while it becomes like you might as well be saying, you know, elephant over and over again.
Yes, that's really true.
Have you guys ever seen Four Weddings and a Funeral?
I don't think so.
The movie?
Yeah, when it came out, I don't really remember it that well.
The first scene. You know, that's how the movie starts. They've overslept and they wake up and they just say that word over and over and over.
Oh,
it's actually really funny.
Oh yeah, but if it's for comedy, I think that's an entirely different thing.
No, absolutely.
Yeah. This is supposed to be comedy as well, but it gets wearing because You would like that these women who have been established as intelligent would find a different way of dealing with their problems. I understand all of us have to give in sometimes. I mean, there is that famous expression, sometimes all you can do is say what the, you know, I mean, I understand that. But all things considered, I think it would be a very good playwriting exercise at the very least, if indeed the playwright were to try a different approach to solve this scene.
My point with Four Weddings and a Funeral was that it's also in context. You know, when I sat down with my friends and we watched it, we all laughed hysterically. But when my mom walked in the room, we were like comfortable. So, and you know, my mom is the Manhattan Theater crowd audience. You know,
mm-hmm. Gotcha.
So let's move on to news before we wrap up the day. Peter chronicled the return of Ruthless in one of his columns this week, and I'm going to put a link in there for folks to check that out. In other big news outside of the theater community, but I thought we should mention, is that Misty Copeland has been named head ballerina at ABT.
Yeah, that's really nice.
And that seems like, you know, the month of June brought all sorts of cultural breakthroughs.
Yeah, it certainly
really
did.
Really amazing. And but many, many folks on Broadway were talking about it and on social media and in conversations. And I think that it's important for us to recognize the breakthrough that Misty Copeland has had in the dance world. Mm-hmm. I listened to a lot of podcasts, and Debbie Gibson was on Brian Koppelman's podcast, The Moment. And if you are a fan of Broadway or of Debbie Gibson, I would encourage you to go listen to this, because she talks about how so much of her art is based in theater and growing up and doing plays, and how much she adores Broadway, and why, in fact, she did not make a lot of a lot more records than she had, because they pointedly asked her. They said, you know, if you, you know, we look on a calendar here, you stopped making records. And she said, I did 17 theatrical shows in 17 years. And when you're doing that, you can't make a record. And this is what I wanted to do. So I'll post a link to that. And
when I talked to her when she was playing Louise and Gypsy in the Betty Buckley paper mill production of Gypsy, she really impressed me when saying much the same thing you're talking about here. And what I also liked was her saying, I really don't like being around people who are negative. And I have found that by being positive, so many wonderful things have happened to me. I just don't allow negativity into my life. And I hope that's still true. But I think it's something all of us need to be reminded of. We're much better off by being positive.
I produced a recording with Debbie on it. Oh, my goodness. I want to say in 97 or something like that. Uh-huh. And I couldn't tell you that, you know, when they first came to me, the writers came to me and said, you know, we want Debbie Gibson to do this. I was very negative on it. And I was
sure.
Like, I don't know how this is going to work. And she totally turned me around. She is just like you mentioned about Jake Gyllenhaal, she's a really hard worker. She is incredibly knowledgeable. You know, we have this,
I found that too.
This public persona of her being this, this bubblegum rock, you know, pop star. It is totally false. She is so smart. It's absolutely incredible. So if you're a fan of Broadway or Debbie Gibson, please take a listen to this the podcast that she was on with Brian Koppelman. Riedel brings us that that Drabinski wants to come back to Broadway.
God.
So we'll have to check that out and see what happens there. And
he's paid his debt to society.
No,
has he paid his investors? No, but he's paid his debt to society.
Well, he has paid his debt to society. But raise the money and get somebody to trust him, and get equity to trust him, and all the other unions. And
that sounds hard.
It's an uphill battle.
Sure is.
It's a really uphill battle, but you know.
Yet, of course, you know, as Michael mentioned in his piece, but I remember Richard Maltby talking to me about this, saying, God, what a producer, though. He gave you everything you needed. He was so behind you. He really supported you. No matter what it was you asked, you got. You know, so Richard Maltby felt very bad about the fact that it worked out the way it did, because this was on Fosse, by the way. The musical.
I was just going to ask, where did Maltby? Okay, Fosse,
yeah, it was the musical Fosse. So it's sad when you hear that somebody is so good at one thing and so terrible at another, and it keeps that person from, needless to say, being successful or out of jail.
Yeah.
Well, Aarons and Flaherty always spoke well of him too. But I would be like, yeah, but
yeah.
It's not only how we're treated if someone is criminal, you know, and yeah, and
sure.
he wouldn't have been able to be that magnanimous if he wasn't stealing money from people.
Absolutely.
But so anyway, did you guys see? I guess this is big news that Sayonara is coming back.
I'm seeing it Tuesday.
Yeah. I'm just looking up now some of the history of it. I thought it had made it to Broadway, but no. It started at Paper Mill in 1987.
There.
Yeah. Oh, you saw it there?
I saw it before that at Paper Mill. They did a workshop to which I was invited. I never saw the main stage production, but then I did see it in Houston. It was done at Theater Under the Stars, so it was done there. It's a good show.
It's good.
It's good.
The Pan-Asian Rep is doing it, and it's it sounds great, because I'm sure a lot of people are going to be intrigued and go just to see the show itself, and so hopefully they'll do a good job with it.
It's good.
So we will talk about it next week then, and see which you're thinking about it next week. Yeah. So Sayonara is playing at the Clurman on 42nd Street. So Peter will have to give us a report on that. And last but not least is that Ken Davenport has started a podcast. He's about a year into it, and he's had some really amazing guests. And I think I've mentioned them a few times before, but last week's guest was Ben Brantley, and he spoke to Ben for about an hour about all the questions really want to ask Ben. I really suggest people, if they want to get in the mind of Ben Brantley, they listen to it. It's very interesting how Ken asked him a question about, you know, does he have any friends in the theater? And Ben said no. And Ken says, well, you've been doing this for how long? How come you have no friends in the theater? He says, because I can't review them if I'm friends with them.
Well, sure.
Yeah. And I thought that was interesting, because we often, you know, review people that we know. Mm-hmm. And some people, you know, I don't know, maybe I go easier on my friends. I don't think I do. But I think my hardest critic is my mom.
Well, also, I mean, it gets down to the definition of friends. I mean, I have spoken to people, and you know, but I don't hang out with them, and
right.
So, you know,
right.
And in those rare cases when I do, I always like to try to mention that first, just as a full disclosure. But Ben, I'm told, I didn't see it, was also on Theater Talk recently, so maybe he's upping his profile in that sense.
Ben's on Theater Talk, you know, on ongoing basis.
I didn't see it.
But they had a Theater Talk episode right before the Tonys, where they had Isherwood, Ben, they had Charles McNulty from LA Times, and Peter Marks in a really good panel. It's about an hour long, but I'll grab a link to that and throw it in the show notes so listeners can know to check that out as well.
Yeah, and getting back to Ken Davenport, it's just been announced that he's going to be bringing the Deaf West theater production of Spring Awakening to. Have they said Broadway?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. This is the company that did that wonderful production of Big River some years ago, and they've done a lot of things since then. But they're based in L.A., and so he's going to bring that here. I think it could work. I'm just thinking about how that show could work with a mixture of deaf and speaking actors, deaf and hearing actors. I believe I've read that in this production that Wendla is played by a deaf actor, whereas Melchior, for example, is played by a hearing actor. So I wonder what they do with Moritz. I could certainly see him being played by a deaf actor. And when they do that, by the way, they always have another actor who's singing the role and singing the role behind them. I'm just so I like that show. First of all, I know a lot of people don't, obviously it's not for everyone, but I love the show to begin with. So I'm really interested to see how they do it.
So, I totally forgot I was going to mention that Deaf West, announcement. And, I sort of feel like we interviewed somebody that talked about Deaf West in the last couple of months, and they were mentioning how good this Spring Awakening was, but I can't remember who it was. Do you guys remember?
No, but the one I want to see that I saw a workshop of from this company is the Cyrano de Bergerac, where the problem is not the nose at all. The problem is Christian is his brother, and the brother is deaf, and he interprets for the brother. So it's a very, very high concept, smart adaptation, and I wish that one would show up. I was amazed that it hasn't. This was about 3 years ago I saw it. They auditioned it for the New York Theater Workshop, and I ran up to James Nicole afterwards and said, "You must do it." Well, he didn't listen to me, and I'm not not that I have all the answers, God knows, but anyway, I mean, I really implored him to do it because I was so moved by it. I never do that, go up to people and say, "Here's what you must do," but this one moved me so much. So this is a great company, and while I have had issues with Spring Awakening in the past, I am going with a very open mind because I won't be surprised if they come up with something really, really wonderful. Not just the fact some people are deaf and some are not. I think there's going to be more to it than that, just as it was with the Cyrano. So I hope there will be.
Oh, and as there was with Big River, too. I mean, it's not just a gimmick. Please.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah.
But there are so many shows where that can be used as a really powerful metaphor. Like, for example, in Spring Awakening, Venla is she's like a 14-year-old girl living in that society. She's not going to have a voice in the same way that other people do. And the same thing with Moritz, who's very much the outsider. So those are just two examples from one show.
Yeah, I agree.
So I quickly looked up in our archives here back on March 15th. We had Ted Chapin on the show and Peter. Oh. Peter talked about the Deaf West and Cyrano, and
was that what it was?
And yeah, and so that's where I remember it from. So let's wrap up for today. I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us on iTunes. You can listen to us many other ways. One of the ways is the Stitcher app, which is an application for your iPhone, your BlackBerry, or your Android device. That way, This Week on Broadway will be automatically streamed to you there. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m., and contact information for Michael, for Peter, and for me, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today, can be found at BroadwayRadio.com. Michael gave us the trivia question before, so if you have the trivia answer to the song that was cut from the movie of Little Shop of Horrors, email us at trivia@BroadwayRadio.com. And also the answer to last week's trivia, which many, many folks got, was Joanna from Sweeney Todd. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye. Why is she talking like a big black woman? And when I give him back, he won't be able to walk. Yeah!